1-3-3-1-1-3. Initiating broadcast of Fascinating Nouns in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fascinating Nouns. Now, if you are listening to this transmission, we are still the galaxy's most trusted source for incredible people, places, things, and ideas. Now, together we arrive at this curious nexus point, and we will explore the strange, unusual, offbeat, bizarre, intriguing, interesting, invigorating, quirky, quaint, quizzical, weird, wild, wacky, the fun, the frivolous, and the fringe, plus all the spaces in between. I am your host, Daniel J. Glenn. Hello, Fascination. Welcome to the show. So, you know, I like to really find the origin story for everything, you know, especially the things that I'm interested in. And as you know, I have another podcast about pop culture science, and we pull a lot of our things from science fiction. Science fiction is a very popular genre. And, you know, I know it began with Georges Méliès and A Trip to the Moon. But as far as television goes, in the modern era, where did it begin? Turns out, it's a show called Science Fiction Theater, which was an anthology show right at the beginning of television, and it really set the stage and influenced a lot of great science fiction shows that to follow, including one of my favorites, The Twilight Zone. And luckily, there's a man who just recently wrote a book about science fiction theater, and that's J.P. Talat, and we're going to talk to him today, and I can't wait to get into this. Jay, thank you so much for being on the show today. Just so I understand, it's J.P. Talat. But J also stands for J-A-Y, so kind of like Homer J. Simpson in a way, right?
Exactly. This was simply one of those early on academic choices, okay. Something that makes you sound more whatever, part of the academic world. And once you get the first couple of publications out there, it's almost impossible to change it back.
Right.
And I published prolifically right away after getting my degree. So the ball took the momentum and just kept rolling.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, the gigantic boulder in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Exactly.
You could not run it, Jay, which is a problem. I mean, yeah, H.P. Lovecraft, right? I don't think he goes as Howard very often. I think it's Howard. I don't know. Maybe it's not Howard. Maybe
yes, it
Terry.
Is. Yeah.
Is it Howard? Okay. I wasn't sure Howard's a great name. If your name's Howard, unless your name's Howard Stern, I'm guessing you're going to go with H.P., which is one way to do that. So this is, you know, so you are a recent retiree, right? You were you're a Georgia Tech Yellow Jacket, but a very recent retiree. Are you enjoying retired life, even though it seems like you're still got a lot of output?
2021, and so far most of it has been taken up with either doing the same sort of thing I did before, and that is reading, researching, and writing, or is dealing with my wife. and you can imagine trying to balance those things off.
Sure, I can. It sounds like you've got a lot going on in your retired life. So a lot of plates. You got to keep a lot of plates spinning. It sounds like. I don't want to date you here, but in 1976 you got your PhD. This is the same year that Jaws came out. You got your PhD in film. And I love this learning about why people decided to get advanced degrees in film. You know, what was it about the genre or not even the genre, that particular discipline that spoke to you?
Well, my PhD is not actually in film. It is in English, because that was a department I was studying in.
Okay. All right.
And they offered film classes as well. And so I took a great number of the film classes while also doing work on modern literature.
Got it.
And so when
okay.
I came out, in fact, one of the books that I wrote about in my dissertation was Walker Percy's novel, The Moviegoer, which won the National Book Award as the best novel of the year. So even the literature that I was investigating, I was constantly fascinated by the movies. And so with the movie courses I was taking and the literature that I was looking at that focused a lot on movies, that became my real concern. You know, I published a bit on literature early on, but it was, my first actual publication was something on Stanley Kubrick.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. What was it about? The Shining, 2001, I'm guessing.
No, it was not 2001. It was the film that had just come out, Barry Lyndon.
Okay. All right. That's an interesting choice. There's a lot of good stuff to talk about in a paper for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a natural pick to write about for someone who had a foot in literature and a foot in film.
Yeah.
Because
that's
it was a famous novel that was being adapted.
Yes, that's right. Well, so what was it about film that drew you to it, right? I mean, you're in the fancy pants English department doing literature, you know, you're doing all that stuff. You know, film, look, I'm a film guy myself. You know, we like to, you know, there's a hierarchy in media. You know, people in film like to turn their nose up at television. Television turns their nose up at the internet. Theater turns their nose up at everyone else. And the English majors turn their nose up at all things media except for books. So what drew you there, you know, at that particular time?
Well, I had a very eclectic undergraduate preparation.
All right.
I went through a program at Loyola University, which had an English department, but practically none of the courses were about English or English literature.
Okay.
So I had courses in strange things like 19th century European drama, or the romanticism. Exclusive of English romanticism.
Okay.
But also film class.
Sure, of course. Got to throw that in there.
Were the ones that really stood out. And so my tastes were shaped by a very eclectic undergraduate program.
Okay.
And so when I went to University of Florida for the PhD, I was intrigued by the fact that it had the same kind of eclectic possibilities. And so even as I was reading and working in literature, I was also taking the film classes there. And in fact, I wrote my qualifying, we had to do a qualifying exam. And I wrote my qualifying exam on John Ford and Sam Peckinpah.
Oh, there you go. Westerns.
But it really was the excitement of the image, if you will.
Yeah.
I think that is what rules here.
Yeah.
And in fact, one of the things I'm working on right now is the way in which television in its early days played off of that excitement of the image.
I think it's true. I mean, you know, for the intellectual, right, the theater of the mind is king. You know, reading a book, reading a play, seeing all these things in your mind is really important. You know, theater, you have, you know, kind of the energy and electricity of a live performance that where anything could kind of go wrong, you know, or it could go right, or something magical could happen that night. And with TV, especially as things started to be recorded and on film and later tape, someone knows what's going to happen beforehand and it's all kind of sterilized, but it's still, you don't really have to put all the pictures in your mind. And some people, you know, the things that people did in film and TV look even better than the original source material, the book or the play.
Definitely.
And others, it's worse.
I would argue that Barry Lyndon is one of those.
Yes. Yeah. Well, anything's too, I mean, Kubrick's, you know, a genius. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen the documentary Room 237, but it gives you a different appreciation for, you know, what he was doing on multiple levels, you know, which is, I think, something you can only do in film. But you became, you know, you became very attracted, at least in your publications here, Jay, to science fiction. You know, you've written a lot of books on science fiction, some on film noir, one of my favorite genres. You wrote a book on robot ecology, which I'm assuming is computerized plants, and Disney. One of these four is not like the other. Why Disney? What drew you to them?
Well, a constant fascination with Disney.
Okay.
I created a course called Film and / as Technology.
Okay.
And I was supposed to be introducing the students to the various types of film technology. What do we do to create these wonderful images?
Yeah.
And to make these great stories. But simply talking about one technology, then another becomes very boring. Students quickly turn off. So I had to find ways of anchoring it. And first I tried doing it with just a sort of historical effort, historical emphasis. That didn't work quite as well. I then tried anchoring it in studios. There were two studios that immediately stood out, Warner Brothers and mm-hmm. Disney, mm-hmm. because both of them essentially worked along and were successful along with the development of the key technologies involved right. in movies.
Yeah.
And in fact, Disney turns out to be more the case than even a Warner Brothers, you know, a big studio like Warner's. Because, you know, Disney pioneers the sound in animation. Disney is the first studio out of all the studios to use Technicolor. When Disney goes into sound usage, they're the first studio to create their own sound system, and it's a surround sound system, which we did for Fantasia.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then when we get into the 1950s, and we have a couple of the studios trying to distinguish themselves from television and create new ways of doing the image, such as a CinemaScope, mm-hmm. Disney jumps on that bandwagon. In fact, it has to borrow CinemaScope lenses, mm-hmm. a lens, because from 20th Century Fox, because Fox only had two lenses at the time.
Right.
And so Disney had to borrow one of the lenses to shoot 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Wow, I didn't know that.
at every step in the development of various film technologies, and of course it extends beyond film now, Disney has been one of the foremost proponents of using technology, leveraging technology to get the most amazing narrative. So that's all.
Yeah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense because – you know, I'm starting to see a pattern here, Jay, because, you know, Disney, you're talking about technology, which is really science fiction. You become, you know, kind of enamored with that. Is that, I mean, were you into science as a kid? Were you a science fiction? Were you an astronaut instead of a cowboy?
I was both.
Okay.
I was really into spaceships. And in fact, I did see some of the, I'm a child of the 1950s. So I grew up with some of the leading space shows of the 1950s.
Yep.
But I also was and this goes back to Disney again, because Disney's responsible for this. I was also a Davy Crockett fan.
Okay.
And
did you have the hat? Did you have the coonskin cap or whatever?
I did not have a coonskin cap. I had everything else, but I wouldn't wear a coonskin cap. Sorry.
I don't know that you're a fan here, Jay. I'm questioning your fandom here. You got to be committed to the role. But that's okay. You wouldn't look, that may have passed in the 1950s, but if you're going to be a fan today, you got to go all out. People are nuts nowadays, especially with their cosplay.
I don't have a space helmet either.
Right, I know, that's what I mean. So if you're not walking around in a space helmet, how can you possibly say you enjoy watching a science fiction show? I mean, this is ludicrous nowadays. What I like, so we're talking about science fiction theater. This is the name of your eponymous book, Science Fiction Theater, which looks like you're grabbing. Are you grabbing one? Let me look at that. There it is. Science Fiction Theater. Look at that beautiful copy of the book. And this, you know, what I like about this is it kind of encapsulates everything we're talking about. Science fiction. We even mentioned theater briefly. But what I like about it is it's kind of this moment in time where radio becomes television. And then that nucleus of science fiction television really inspires every science fiction show, even the science fiction adjacent shows, you know, up to today, including anthologies, which are really now miniseries. You know, we don't really have anthology shows as much anymore. They're more like the miniseries, your American Horror Stories, your Fargo's, some of the same actors, different roles. But instead of one episode, it's 8 or 10 or 12. So this is why I really enjoyed reading about this. And one thing here. You know, you told me something that, you know, I never knew. I did not make this connection, Jay. And I am known as the master of film and television. And Back to the Future might be one of my favorite movies of all time. I've seen it hundreds of times. And I did not make the connection. There's a moment in the film where Marty is trying to convince George to ask Lorraine to the Enchantment Under the Sea dance. One of the pivotal moments in the film. And George says, I can't because I have to go home and watch science fiction theater. I didn't make that connection until you mentioned it in your book. And I have to give you my heartfelt thanks for bringing that, opening my eyes to that little nugget, that little tidbit.
And, you know, that little tidbit was almost on the cutting room floor.
Was that right?
We always had I've had several contretemps with the editor at Wayne State University Press, the publisher of the book.
Oh, what's a contretemps? Hold on, we got to define that. What's
a contretemps? A little disagreement.
Oh, okay. That's a fancy, polite way to say disagreement. I like that. Contretemps. Yeah. All right, please continue.
As a contretemps.
Contretemps
against. Time against time.
Okay.
Oh. So anyway, that's something that I originally cut out, and then we talked about putting it back in. So in and out. It wound up being in. I couldn't find the right place for it. And finally, at the end of the book, we threw that in. It was a nice way of getting us out of the past into the future. Back to the future.
That's clever. Well, you know, I think that might be the most, and this is not to, you know, to disparage any of your work that you did on this book, but in my humble opinion, I think that might be the most important part of the book. I think it should be front and center. At least it was to me. That would change my life, you know, for a little bit. So let's talk about science fiction theater. This is, you know, I want to go back to science fiction for just a second, because one thing I forgot to mention, and, you know, this science fiction theater kind of inspired one of my favorite TV shows of all time, The Twilight Zone. And I think The Twilight Zone might be, you know, people will watch it now and it'll be taken out of context or not really given the full appreciation given the limitations and special effects and the kind of formulaic editing that kind of went on at the time. But I think it's probably one of the most intelligent, well-written shows of all time. I don't know that there are many that can really surpass it. And science fiction is such a great genre because, you know, Rod Serling wasn't a science fiction fan. He just wanted to be political and have social commentary. And science right. fiction is the best cover for that. You can kind of do whatever you want. You know, one of his famous quotes is, you know, an alien can say something a Republican and a Democrat can't, which in a lot of ways, and I'm sure you feel this way, science fiction becomes one of the most powerful forms of entertainment, despite it not really necessarily having the critical appeal that I think people look for.
Well, you know, let me touch on at least two of the points you just made.
Okay.
And both in terms of Twilight Zone. One is that I ran across an article in one of the trade magazines, trade papers, from 1957, I believe it was.
Okay.
And so this is the last year of science fiction theater. And the article was referencing Rod Serling, who was apparently going around with an idea for a science fiction anthology show.
Okay.
At that early date.
Wow.
So that's a further link and suggestion of the influence that it was having on him, because he was already at the top of his game at that point. Probably the best known and most successful writer in serious television. Maybe Lucy and Desi were more important in non-serious television,
right? Fair enough.
Of that period, but anyway, he's already working on that.
Yeah,
he's already thinking along those terms.
Yep.
So that's one of the points that needs making. The other is. Twilight Zone, I think, is the most cinematic of early television, and there's one really great reason for that. And this may tie us back into science fiction theater. I don't know if we talk about budgets or something like that, but.
That's what everyone's waiting for us to do. Everyone's waiting for us to get to the financials and talk about budgets and byline. You know,
Rod Serling is shooting his when he does shoot Twilight Zone starting in 59. He has a veteran, one of the 20-year record of work in movies, his cinematographer. So he has someone who has an extremely sophisticated and established sense of cinema aesthetics. But even more important than that, he's shooting at MGM Studio.
Right.
He has the complete backlot of MGM at his beck and call. And so you find all these fantastic sets and props showing up in the Twilight Zone. There are at least three Twilight Zone episodes that have Robbie the Robot from Forbidden Planet.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah.
In fact, the most my favorite episode, one of the early episodes of Twilight Zone, is the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street.
Yeah, it's a good one.
And it's a story about the electricity going off and the lights going off and suddenly everything is going haywire on this sleepy little suburban town. And it turns out it's because there are aliens there.
Spoiler alert. Yeah.
Spoiler alert. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
But first off, the town is the town set from all the Andy Hardy films, Carville, city.
Yeah.
Where all the Andy Hardy films were shot. So we're talking what 10 or 11 Andy Hardy films are shot there. So it has this wonderful set. But also the when the aliens are revealed, we see that they're wearing the costumes from Forbidden Planet,
mm-hmm.
And their spaceship is the spaceship from Forbidden Planet.
So the prop master from Forbidden Planet didn't keep a track of his keys, is what you're saying, or they had carte blanche to kind of raid the wardrobe and.
Basically, they had carte blanche.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's well, and it's amazing because, you know, you mentioned the Monster Duo on Maple Street. That might be one of my favorite episodes of The Twilight Zone, because I think the beauty is in its simplicity. It's simply shot. There's not a lot of special effects. It's, you know, you have just basically people and their environment is changing in such a way that it's changing them. But it's very simple. It is lights going off. It's a show, you know, it's an episode about paranoia and how people can turn on their neighbors and what happens when fear and panic take over. And it's just so simple. And it's a quintessential to, I think, Rod Serling's writing, is that you don't need all the special effects to tell a very compelling science fiction story. And I think science fiction theater, which takes a lot of its, you know, a lot of its direction from old time radio, I like that as well, because in old time radio, you don't have a visual component. It's all audio and things have to be simple, and you're still trying to wow an audience. You know, there was a whole kind of arms race of, you know, how can we have a more surprise ending after surprise ending, you know, when it comes to these types of old radio shows. And I think science fiction theater kind of did that in a way. You know, in a weird sense, science fiction theater's budget really comes from the research arm, which is also a strange element. So I think, you know, I think you're right. I think, you know, it's simple, and science fiction theater, I think, is very influential with Rod Serling and The Twilight Zone.
Yeah, and again, we can go back to budgets there. Serling had all these wonderful things at his beck and call. He didn't have an enormous budget, but he had lots of things that you would otherwise have to budget for. Science fiction theater had a decent budget for its time, and that is they were spending $1.5 million for a season, but that season was stretching out over 39 episodes
each year. Right, yeah.
So that's not a lot per episode. I figure that's they're probably spending about $20,000-$25,000 per episode, and then they have a separate research group that has a separate budget, and that was something totally new for television. They have a separate research component like that.
Well, I will say one thing that's interesting here for people listening: shrinkflation in television, I think is a good thing. 39 episodes over the course of a season is way too many. I mean, I remember, you know, just recently 24 episodes was what the standard was for most things. And that's a lot. And now you've got 10 and 12, which I think is perfect. So I'm all for shrinkflation when it comes to television. Let's condense the good. Let's purify it and you know, make it the best. But this is interesting. So let's talk about this. I was kidding about research. No one's actually listened to the show for budgets. But I think this is a good point here, Jay, because the research budget is really important, because this show, the hook, Science Fiction Theater's hook was, it's amazing because it's science, compelling because it's fiction. They went to, large institutions, USC, MIT, Johns Hopkins, Cal Institute of Tech, University of Pennsylvania. They were going to scientific institutions, paying their research to find cutting edge science, and then turning that into science fiction shows. And they had a research budget for it. I think that's really what makes this unique, Jay. This is what was really interesting to me. I never heard of this before.
Yeah, totally new. The only other, there were totally new for fictional approaches.
Right, yeah.
There are other science shows in that period. There's the Johns Hopkins Science Review. There's a show called Science in Action. Disney, Frank Capra and the Bell Science series. And then Disney with its Man in Space, its Tomorrowland shows. So all these are doing real research. They're presenting real science. And of course, I grew up with another element of that show that I didn't mention in the book and probably should mention at some point, but that some people will recall, and that is Meet Mr. Wizard.
Yeah.
And Meet Mr. Wizard was a scientist. Well, they called him a scientist who would do experiments on television with kids, and so he would introduce them to concepts of science by doing experiments, demonstrating certain things.
Now, let me ask a question there, because when I was growing up in like the 80s and 90s, there was a Mr. Wizard on Nickelodeon. Is this the same guy, just doing it on a different show?
Oh, of course not. No, no.
I don't know how old the other guy, the original Mr. Wizard was.
Yeah, he was 40 or so in the 1950s, okay. Mid-50s.
Now, Mr. Wizard from the 80s, he wasn't a spring chicken, by the way. I don't know if he was 100 years old. But, you know, he was a good looking 70-year-old, I guess I could say.
All right.
But different guys, different people.
But probably not the same
guy. Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. But this was going on, is what you're saying. So science research budgets for science wasn't unheard of. But in a fiction show, this was pretty different.
The fiction shows, it was different. I mean, after all, when Disney, in the same period as science fiction theater, Disney is doing its Tomorrowland shows. And they're not doing very many of them. And they're putting tons of money into those shows because they are what Disney referred to as science factual shows.
Yes.
So he would bring in Wernher von Braun. He would bring in Heinz Haver. He would bring in all sorts of major figures, and they would help to write the shows. But he didn't do very many of those, and he was spending between $100,000 and $200,000 per episode on those shows, whereas science fiction theater, as we just said, you know, spending $20,000 to $25,000 on an episode.
Wait, so no, hold on. So Wernher von Braun was writing episodes of television?
He was helping Disney on
Disney
on his Man in Space series.
Well, given Disney's anti-Semitic history, that doesn't surprise me that a Nazi scientist would go from making rockets for Hitler to then writing science shows for Disney. What a world. You can't. I did not know that.
Well, no, actually this, and we're getting a little far
sure
away from science fiction theater.
Yeah.
But it's worth noting that because it demonstrates a sort of burgeoning science consciousness. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that von Braun was brought in had nothing to do with Disney and his interest in him. I don't think he ever heard of him. The fellow he had tasked with directing these shows had been reading this series of articles that were in Collier's magazine, and the Collier's magazine series was highly praised in its day. It was about 1953-54, and they had it was a result of a conference that brought together the top scientists in all sorts of different fields, but particularly to focus their different energies and different expertise on the problems of exploration space. And so here's this series that makes national headlines, and von Braun is picked out because he is photogenic and he's eager and he's he has all kinds of energy that he wants to communicate to people how important it is to go out and investigate space. And so he's showing up on national TV. And so the director for the Disney series has read the articles. He's seen this guy. He's the one that says, can you give me the money to bring this guy?
Got it. Okay. So, all right.
So I don't want to lay this at Walt Disney's doorstep. Yeah. But I do want to lay it at Ward Kimball. Ward Kimball is the director of that series.
Sure, sure. Only in America. Only in America can that happen. So I think that this, you know, this is an interesting transition because the 1950s for science fiction is a really interesting time because you do have the Cold War. You know, you've got Roswell in 1947. So you've got alien invasions on people's mind. You've got, I can never remember the... at Mount Rainier, always forget the guy who saw all the flying saucers. He termed the flying saucer.
Right.
I cannot remember his name. I'll find it at some point. Anyway, you've got the...
He's in my book, by the way.
Is he? I don't... Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So, but I can't come up with his name. It's going to come to me.
And I can't either.
Oh, man. But it'll get there. But you, of course, you've got the atom bomb. So you've got, you know, all sorts of apocalyptic movies. You got radiation fears. You got giant bugs in the 1950s. So there's a huge interest in science fiction. But they're a little... You mentioned in your book, they're a little dystopian. You know, a little more what I'm interested in. I like those kinds of movies. But TV... wanted to show kind of a way forward, you know, a way for science not to be the bad guy, but to help mankind. And I think that that's kind of where science fiction theater comes in. You know, you mentioned space operas were really popular, and those were kind of, you know, your Buck Rogers, Tom Corbett, Space Cadet, the exploring space. I think Star Trek kind of fits into a space opera as well. Star Wars. These are obviously much later in time, but just so people get a general idea. And those are, you know, there's not really much going on. They're kind of fluff. It's really Westerns in space. But I think that science fiction theater really wants to show that we've got real science and we've got these fun stories, but at the end, science is what saves the day, right? I mean, that's kind of what goes on in every single episode, if I remember correctly.
It's pretty close, but there's an awful lot of science is limited. And
yes. Okay. Yeah.
Can we always trust it? Yeah. You know, one of the episodes is entitled "When a Camera Fails." And there are a number of those episodes where the science fails. The science can't account for something.
Yes.
The scientific equipment breaks down, or the scientific equipment or development is used wrongly.
Okay.
You know, for example, one scientist, a rogue, as we're told in one of the episodes, he develops something that can. Make you lose all sense of time. It basically stops time. And so when he uses this on his former lab mates and goes in and steals their ideas and steals their developments. And then this thing shows up somewhere and they have no idea. How did it leak out of the lab? Well, it's because one of the scientists is using the technology that he's developed in a wrong way. There are always this sense of, and this goes, of course, well with the movies in that period that are all also very often talking about science gone wrong.
Yes.
With mutated bugs and birds and other things.
Yeah, no, that is true. Well, one of the other things that I think is interesting about science fiction theater is you talk about there are some, look, this is a time, you know, you mentioned Ziv Productions, who made science fiction theater, that Ziv wanted to do things cheap, not inexpensive, but cheap, which I thought was, normally it's the opposite way. You don't want it cheap, you want it to be inexpensive. But I thought that was, but you got formula, right? If you try to save money, formula helps a lot. And one of the formulas, you know, and it is that there's a strange old man in an episode who seems to have a knowledge of some kind of scientific phenomenon that is unknown to human beings. Typically, this person is of unknown origin, whether it's alien or extra dimensional, or they come from somewhere else. They show up, do something crazy, and then disappear. We don't know. But, you know, the Strange Lodger is one of the episodes you highlight in your book.
My very favorite.
Is that really? That's your favorite one? That it's so, and this one's kind of interesting for a lot of different reasons. There's a lot of cool things going on in this episode, but basically he has the ability to transmit energy from his using television and UHF signals. But anyway, the details aren't important. What's important is that he has some power. People don't understand what's going on. They kind of, at the end of the episode, get a sense of what's happening, but it's really the idea that there are possibilities out there that we have yet to discover. And that's the importance of science, is always moving ahead and finding these amazing things. Anything's possible, really. And I think that's at least what I took from all of the stranger in the desert kind of episodes.
Yeah. They're the little old man who keeps showing up . You know, this opens the door onto one other aspect of the series, and that is this is a period when the actors who have been under contract to the major studios have all been let go. The studios are letting go of all their long contracted talent, and that talent is finding a new home in television. And so you get someone like Edmund Gwenn, a British actor who was in tons of films in the 1940s and early 1950s. He's in, I believe, three different Hitchcock films, for example.
Oh, wow.
You know, Edmund Gwenn is one of those. He also, of course, plays Kris Kringle in
Miracle on 34th Street.
Exactly.
All right.
You got it. So anyway, he's Santa Claus for many people. He looks like Santa Claus. And so he shows up in about three of these episodes in the course of two seasons, always playing the strange little old man who has some special power, whether it's here's a universal energy source. All you gotta do is do this and you'll have universal energy, free energy, or just has some other special knowledge. Or he can appear and disappear, whatever. There's that sense of the kindly old man who might just happen to be an alien, or as you say, might be interdimensional, or might be a time traveler, because there are time travelers in other episodes of science fiction theater. But the reason I especially like that episode that you mentioned, is that, one is it's the very last episode of the series.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And it seems to me that there's a little bit of thumbing of the nose at the TV industry.
Definitely. Now that you say that, it makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Because it all revolves around this little old man, as you say, we've detected him sending signals or receiving signals. We're not sure. And we call in groups of the 50s, but the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission.
Yeah.
They call in a representative of the Federal Communications Commission because these strange signals that have been detected, they're operating on a channel 84, and the FCC has not allocated a channel 84. The FCC is in charge of saying who can use what channels. Mm-hmm. And what they've done up to this point is they've allowed the networks to control those basic channels, the VHF channels, not the UHF channels. UHF channels haven't been allocated yet. And so the FCC is got a heavy hand. And they're one of the I'm trying to temper my statement here, but
sure.
They're one of the enemies of someone like Ziv.
Yeah.
Because Frederick Ziv and his company, they're syndicators.
You're right.
And they are being forced, as you said before, we had to do things on the cheap. Well, they're being forced to do things on the cheap because he wants to make money. But two, because the networks are exercising almost a total control over who can get things on the air and therefore and how much they'll pay you to put these things on the air. And so this is that last episode, I just get this sense that they decided to let it all out. Here's what's gone wrong with American television. It's being totally controlled by the FCC and the networks. And even more than that, it's being, and in addition, it's being controlled by the newly established ratings groups.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going with first, because that's when you say they who calls in the FCC is a guy running around in a van taking the ratings by just looking at people's antennas with their equipment and figuring out what people are watching. That's where I thought you were going. But this is one of those weird instances where science fiction, as we mentioned earlier, is a great cover for social commentary. But in a lot of ways, the social commentary here is way more overt. You know, I mean, it's literally a guy running around doing ratings. It's the FCC coming in. You know, so he's definitely saying what he means in this and not hiding it in any way.
Yeah, the polometer people, as they call themselves.
Right.
We're just going to survey exactly what you're doing without you knowing it.
Right. Yeah, I know.
This is like the government today.
Yeah.
We're going to get out there and find out everything. Yeah. Our worries about all social media that they're going to just soak up all of our personal information. And here we are in the 1950s, 1957, when that episode is made. And they're sounding a warning about that already. The industry and the FCC work together, surveilling everything you do. And it turns out nothing much is being done. Just this little old man is sending images of an encyclopedia out into space somewhere.
Yeah. But that's also interesting because that in a lot of ways is like the third layer of this onion where you've got an alien race being given all of the information about the human species and our culture through an encyclopedia, right? Like he's sending messages, you know, our information about us to an entirely different civilization. Everyone's getting information on someone else without their knowledge or consent. So it is a powerful episode here. But a lot of it's, you know, ahead of its time, right? And one episode that I thought was really interesting is called The Brain of John Emerson. And there's not really, you know, in a lot of ways, there is the man who disappears, you know, because really quickly, this is a story about a man who has traumatic brain damage and he wakes up and all of a sudden his IQ's gone up and he's starting to remember things that, you know, he didn't know before and he knows things he didn't know before. And it turns out that the surgeon who helped him was dying and basically put his brain into this guy's brain via an electronic AI system. Basically, he's recorded his brain, the neurons, onto electric tape and is then transferred that into this the main character's brain, which is early AI here, Jay. Yeah, this is a really, I mean, it's completely impossible, especially with their technology, but this is the cutting edge idea that our brain is just a chemical, electrochemical organ, and it can be recorded like anything we do electronically. So why not map out the brain, you know, with tape? I thought this was a really clever idea, especially for the time.
Yeah, the brain is an electrochemical computer, which we can program as soon as we learn how to program things. And in this case, they're programming it with an electronic signal. But yeah, there are a number of episodes that are all about the powers of the mind and how you can program the mind. This is a period that's also first starting to talk about ESP, extrasensory perception.
Yes.
And so there's one episode where some kind of strange, and they say it might be a spaceship, some strange vehicle is approaching the U.S. And the radar is tracking him, but they can't communicate. But this woman who happens to be part of the science research team, she has ESP, and so she can communicate, and she knows these are aliens that are asking for help. So the mind is suddenly new territory, and this is an amazing development for science fiction television, not only because it really is talking about things that we're more concerned with today, such as, and we do have people who are actually getting brain implants today, as you know.
Yeah.
But because so much of science fiction in the 1950s, from 1949 to 1956, is space opera.
Yeah.
It's the period, you know, Captain Video of, as you said before, Tom Corpus Space Cadet, or my favorite was Space Patrol. There's even a Canadian series called Space Command, which starred James Doohan.
Okay.
Of Star Trek. Scotty.
Scotty. Well, and one thing that's interesting about Tom Corbett. What's interesting about that is you mentioned in the book that show was so popular, at least unkillable, let's say, the cockroach of television, because it was on all of the, at that time, four major networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and the Dumont Network. I'd never heard that before. That's pretty impressive to be on all of the major networks at some point in your tenure on television.
And you have your own comic book.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so, multimedia.
Well, what may be more impressive than that, although I think that is unprecedented and never happened again, and I'm not necessarily a fan of it, but Captain Video, which starts in 1949, and it is not only a daily show, but on weekends, and a radio show at the same time. It's going 5 days a week, 6 days a week. Then they start doing afternoon shows and evening shows as well. Literally thousands of episodes of Captain Video. And unfortunately, we can't do much. Historians, critics, etc., can't do much with them because almost all of them have disappeared.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, the Dumont Network, when they went out of business, they figured, and this is a repetition of what happened in movie industry.
Yeah.
In the early days of the movie industry, they figured, okay, we've shown this movie, and there's no future for it, so. Let's melt it down for the silver content in the silver nitrate film.
Yeah,
so they just didn't see a future for reruns of movies for the most part. And so, you know, more than half the movies that were ever made in the 20th century don't exist anymore.
What I will say here, just, you know, I did a whole episode on the Klondike movie, the Klondike film cache, where in the Klondike, they found buried in the snow movies from the 20s and 30s that were, because they were the last run of any film, and there was nowhere else for it to go. Normally, you'd take a movie show, and they pass it down the line. Yeah, and so they ended up in the Klondike, where there's the end of the line, and, they buried them or burned them or whatever. That's exactly right. It's just interesting because this stuff was all disposable, whether it was television or film, whatever the media was, it was just gone. I mean, theater was ephemeral. It was like you did a production and then that was it. If the production didn't happen again, you didn't see that play with those people doing those lines and that blocking with that set ever again. You know, it was a right. one-time deal. So this is really true. So the permanence of it, I don't think was ever really that. No one ever realized the potential of the permanence trait of film and television.
All right. As I started to say, with Captain Video, when the Dumont company went out of business, most of its stuff was simply tossed into the East River in New York. They'd never found, not that they could have done anything with those copies if they had found them. We have maybe a dozen episodes out of the thousands, several thousand were done, that are still extant.
Wow, that's crazy.
About four of those you can find online, and about another four or five are out in an archive in L.A., and then a couple of episodes, I think, at the George Eastman House Museum. So there's that. But this brings us back to science fiction theater.
Of course it does. Let's get it
in
back.
A powerful way, because as cheap as he may have been or was forced to be, I think Frederick Ziv saw the future, and that's why he was one of those few people who, in making their independent television shows, shot them in color. You know, here's a science fiction show in 1955, 56, 57. They're shooting this in color, even knowing that, one, that makes it more expensive. Knowing that the majority of sets are not going to receive color, not only not the majority, but 95% of the sets are not going to receive it in color. And the networks are not broadcasting it in color. You know, this is something that again, let's circle back here. Walt Disney was one of the few other people to recognize. So Walt Disney knows that ABC is not going to broadcast his new Disneyland TV series in color, but he's going to shoot it in color anyway. He's going to shoot it in color anyway because he's looking at later broadcasts or other kinds of releases. And in fact, Disney was already doing releases of some of its nature shows to schools, and some of its cartoons were being released to schools. He knew there was this whole educational outlet for these things, or you know, Davy Crockett is the most popular mini series in the United States in the 1950s. Nothing else like it. We've sort of forgotten about the impact it had, coonskin caps notwithstanding. But he shoots this in color, and then he cobbles together these three episodes of Davy Crockett into a movie, releases it to theaters. People haven't seen it in color. They've only seen black and white.
Right.
He makes millions of dollars on something that he's already shot. He's already made his money back on television.
Just paying editor.
So now he re-releases this as a movie. And it's a color film that no one has seen. Millions of dollars coming in profit. Free profit. And this is the same thing Ziv is going to do. Ziv recognizes that as a syndicator, you're not necessarily bound by, you know, this season and that season. You can keep syndicating these shows as long as people will buy them. And so as soon as because this science fiction theater was becoming a little bit more expensive with the research arm and things like that, it actually became a better economic proposition for him to release it, to not make any more episodes, but simply to re-release, to re-syndicate elsewhere these color episodes that he has shot. And they're going to be more attractive even into the 1960s because they're color.
What it's the forward thinking on some of these guys, that's really what gets me. So Ziv, just really quickly, you know, he was, I didn't know that they were the largest studio or the largest television. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The largest production and radio packager in the U.S. I didn't know that they were that large. You know, they bought a lot of stock footage, B-roll. They scored their own movies. They bought audio libraries to get around these things, bought their own studio space, and then invested in dubbing stages for the express purpose of exporting this to other countries. I thought that was brilliant in the 1950s, you know, when we're kind of on the cutting edge of technology. The rest of the world, I mean, I don't know what the saturation of televisions. I think by 1960, 90% of Americans had a television. I don't know what that was like in the world, but just the idea that, like, the United States is very small, the world is very big. That's our market. We are going to build for expansion. And that's not something a lot of people were doing, except maybe movie studios. And they were kind of becoming that.
Yeah. Yeah. We have not done the kind of studio or company history of television groups that we have with the motion picture studios.
Yeah, right.
You can find, you know, many volumes on the history of Warner Brothers or MGM, etc. You don't find that on television. And Ziv is one of those unexplored territories that should be talked about more. And it's one of the great fun things I got out of doing this book is learning all about this company and its leader, Frederick Ziv, that I knew very little about. I mean, I grew up with some of his TV series. I watched one of his earliest series, The Cisco Kid, for many, many a year. And it too was one that was 1949. He starts doing this and he's shooting it in color, thinking he's going to, you know, have later use of it when color comes in. But nobody's showing anything in color in 1949. He's got Cisco Kid going. It was so strange. Let me use my common touchstone again, Disney.
Yeah.
Disney plows all of his money into Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. In 1937, 1938, and everyone calls it Disney's folly.
Right.
Why are you spending all this money on this cartoon? All right. So they started saying this, they were saying the same thing about Ziv, about him putting money into a studio in Mexico City to dub a TV series into Spanish. It became the science fiction show in South America. Yeah. It's all over South America.
Yeah.
It worked in South America. Let's do it in France. And so he sets up a studio in Paris. He's got one in Germany. He's got one in Italy. If it had gone on for another year, if he had seen it as profitable to do another season rather than simply to take the money and run by syndicating it. He says in one of the trade papers that he has his eye on the Orient. So he was planning on setting up a studio to do dubbing in Japan. He was a visionary in that regard, and Ziv, I think, is the most influential early producer of science fiction for television, despite the fact that his show lasts only 2 years, and despite the fact that there are all of these space operas running around,
right.
13 in the U.S. alone in that 1949-1956 period.
Yeah, I mean, well, sometimes it pays to be first, you know, because they really set the template. You know, we didn't even really talk about the narrator, but, Bradley, no, it's not Truman Bradley. I always get those mixed up. I'm used to Harry Truman, but Truman Bradley. But, you know, he's the narrator and, you know, he sets up the whole story that's kind of taken from radio as well. So being the first, setting the template is important. It doesn't matter how many years you're on the air, became influential nonetheless. But let's talk just in closing here. I want to talk about the legacy because I think you do a great job in the book of talking about like what happened because of science fiction theater and, you know, real science angles in writing shows. You mentioned a couple of great ones, Doomwatch, Project UFO, The $6 Million Man, Star Trek, you know, making them adult oriented instead of, you know, geared towards children, I think was a big difference. And that scientists were not mad scientists. They were researchers for the using science for the power of good. Problem solvers and, you know, that type of science, and that they were the template for anthology, Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Night Gallery, Black Mirror, Amazing Stories, you know, some more modern approaches, probably in the reverse order. So I think that there's a huge legacy here, which I don't think most people really understand, despite the fact, as you just mentioned, it was only on 2 years. It still really, really set the stage for a lot of great shows to come.
Yeah, and it was running regularly. At least into the early 1960s. And then they changed the title and called it, One Step Beyond or something of that nature.
Yeah.
So it ran into the 1960s. And invariably had created the format that other people were going to take up. And so Twilight Zone, you have the narrator, in this case, Rod Serling. You have the sort of twist endings that often were the case in mm-hmm. science fiction theater. Mm-hmm. You have the strong writer, in this case, Rod Serling himself, but that's strong writers in science fiction theater and a strong figure in charge to make sure everything worked. Rod Serling or
Ivan Tors.
Ivan Tors for science fiction theater.
Yeah.
And so when we come along from Twilight Zone, we get The Outer Limits, and The Outer Limits has Vic Perrin doing the narration mm-hmm. at the beginning and the ending. You've got the same sort of anthology format, voiceover, etc. Mm-hmm. And this is something that we see again when you get to Ray Bradbury Theater a bit later on. Ray Bradbury himself is in charge, and Ray Bradbury is doing the narration and writing the story. So you get the strong figure, anthology, etc. Mm-hmm. Steven Spielberg, Amazing Stories in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
In charge, writes all the stories. Well, I'd say about 60-70% of the stories. Does some narration, does some direction. We can keep going on. Night Gallery, when Rod Serling comes back and does Night Gallery, the same format, a little more horror-oriented. What was what I was thinking of?
I was going to say Tales from the Crypt is a good – that is pure horror. That is not science fiction. Yeah, but all of the same tools, right?
Right.
Yeah, the Crypt Keeper is a narrator. It's an anthology series, twist endings, you know, so it wasn't just limited to science fiction is what I'm trying to say. Like they really set the stage for a lot of different shows. But this was it. Science fiction theater. So how can people find your book or get in touch with you if they want to learn more?
Well, certainly you're welcome to contact Wayne State University Press. But the easiest thing is simply to go out to Amazon and plug in my name or just plug in Science Fiction Theater, and it'll pop up and I'll pop up.
I'll put links on my page helping you find your books. And of course, if you want to find me and you want to find that page that I'm just talking about, you can go to our website, fascinatingnouns.com, and you can find us on social media, X, formerly Twitter, at Fascinating Noun, on Facebook, at Fascinating Nouns. Well, this has been so much fun, Jay, because I love finding the original, the origin story of science fiction or any genre, right? Like, where did it all begin? And it was all science fiction theater. It's all here in your book. So thanks for being on the show and talking about it with me.
And thank you, Daniel. It's a good time. You got me excited again.
That's what I want. I want to make you excited and to make our audience excited. So thank you for being on the show. And of course, I want to thank everyone for listening. Have a good night.
Fascinating Nouns is a Glencoe production and is hosted and produced by me, Daniel J. Glenn. The show producer for this episode was Sarah Brandt. The Fascinating Nouns introduction was produced by Daniel J. Glenn and E.A. Barrientos, with music and sound design written and performed by E.A. Barrientos. And I'm guessing after listening to this, you never want to miss another episode. You're going to want to subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcasting platforms, and we even have links right there on our show website, which is fascinatingnouns.com. You can find all the links right there. And let's say you don't have a favorite podcasting platform. That's no problem. You can listen to every episode right there on the website, which is once again fascinatingnouns.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter. It's a great way to learn more about the episodes that you're listening to, find out about upcoming episodes, and to just keep in touch with the community. It's right there on the website. And speaking of community, there's no better way to stay in touch than on social media. And you can find links to our show's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube pages right there on the front page of fascinatingnouns.com. And speaking of YouTube, there's a video version of this episode there right now, as well as other past episodes and all future episodes. It's going to be right there, youtube.com/Daniel J. Glenn. It's a great way to see all the guests and check it out live and in person. Feel like you're there in studio. Great way to do it, youtube.com/Daniel J. Glenn. And finally, if you like this show, you're going to like everything that I do. Go to danieljglenn.com and check out all of my projects and see what's going on. Once again, thank you for listening.
Code 133113, initiating broadcast of Fascinating Nouns in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fascinating Nouns. Now, if you are listening to this transmission, we are still the galaxy's most trusted source for incredible people, places, things, and ideas. Now, together, we arrive at this curious nexus point, and we will explore the strange, unusual, offbeat, bizarre, intriguing, interesting, invigorating, quirky, quaint, quizzical, weird, wild, wacky, the fun, the frivolous, and the fringe, plus all the spaces in between. I am your host, Daniel J. Glenn.